mentioned at the very, very tip top of class that tonight will be our look into the place of Egypt in our Bibles. Egypt is a mega important, significant, maybe significant's more the word than important, although important too, you know. It is a very focal point of a lot of the Bible's teaching. In Matthew chapter 2, is it? Matthew chapter 2, verse 11. A lot of folks presumably have started a Bible reading program, and if you have for 2019, good on you for doing that. It likely means that the book of Matthew, the early chapters of the book of Matthew, have been recently read by you. You'll note in Matthew 2, verse 13, that Jesus, his family, are called from Egypt. First, they are sent to Egypt as a place of protection, then called from Egypt. Verse 15 there recalls for our memory that Jesus and Mary and Joseph had dealings with Egypt. So here we are in Genesis, not Matthew, although that reference is neat to set the table. In Genesis, we are following still Abraham's seed, which we will be doing for the remainder of our survey of the Old Testament. And now we have come to the children of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you will recall, that's the ancestry that we're dealing with. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Israel had a lot of children, as you may recall reading in Genesis chapter 30. And these children of his become the children of Israel, sometimes in the Old Testament and in our teaching of the Old Testament, referred to simply as Israel. And one of these special children of Jacob was Joseph. Joseph was special to his father for some key reasons, but who recalls one in particular mentioned in Genesis chapter 30? Joseph was the son. Right. Joseph was, thank you, you're right, Sam. Joseph was the son of Rachel, whom Jacob, Israel, same guy, loved very, very much. So Joseph is a beloved son of his father. I'm going to ask you to stand with one foot in the book of Genesis and also one foot in the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, for that matter. As we talk about Joseph, who is the beloved son of his father, precious to his father, but in what regard is Joseph held by his peers, his brethren? Huh? They hated him. Couldn't stand him. And one thing leads to another. You know, we can't bog down in any of these details as juicy and interesting as they are. But Joseph's brothers decide that they're going to do what? They decide they're going to kill him. And then, you know, a few of them get to thinking, well, hey, man, if he's dead to us, you know, that's kind of a one-and-done thing. Might as well make some money off of Joseph. Kill two birds with one stone, you know, get rid of a guy that we hate and get a little bit of spending money. So perhaps prophetically, Joseph is sold, betrayed, and actual money exchanges hands, right? It's beginning to sound a little bit like whom? Jesus. Joseph is definitely a messianic figure. This is not our pictures of the Old Testament class, but Joseph definitely has some of the ring of identifying marks with Jesus. Loved by his father, rejected by his brethren. You know, the Jews famously reject Jesus. Sold out for money by ones closest to him. Who was it who betrayed Jesus? Judas, one of the apostles who were very intimately familiar with Jesus' ministry. For money, right? Money changes hands with both places. And risen from the dead, not literally in Joseph's case, but Joseph has a brand new life, a brand new existence in what strange land? Egypt. Over the river and through the woods, it took Joseph to finally get to Egypt. But sure enough, Joseph is in Egypt, where in Genesis chapter 41, he is remembered for a very unique skill that he has. What was that skill? Joseph was able to do what? Interpret dreams. And would you know it, Pharaoh had a dream about some cows that was troubling him greatly. And Joseph was fetched from prison to come and see Pharaoh and give the interpretation of this dream. And in real quick shorthand, what was this dream predicting in the land? A famine in the land. A great famine in the land. Indeed, right? So this famine would not immediately happen, as Sam reminds us. This famine was yet still awful ways. And not only was the famine yet still awful ways, leading up to the famine, you know, there would be years of plenty. So Joseph, armed with God on his side, suggests to Pharaoh, we get ahead of this famine. You know, if in 7 years, you know, you're going to run out of food, you might want to figure out how you can grow your own food. And Egypt was in a much better position than having to figure out how to grow their own food. They just had to manage what they were growing. And with Joseph's help, with God's help, Egypt became a place of plenty. In fact, during the famine, the whole world came to Egypt to buy from some of their reserved crops and grains. And it's here where who comes to Egypt for their food? Joseph's brothers. And I mean, we've read the scene many times in our Bibles and have imagined it many more times, but just try to imagine reading it for the first time all over again, and you see this incredible reveal. Joseph is seated second in command of Pharaoh. The Bible lets us know that Pharaoh had given him ruling power. Genesis chapter 41 lets us know that Pharaoh didn't know what he had. I mean, Pharaoh was still the guy in Egypt, but Joseph was, you know, a chief operations officer, a chief executive officer. I don't know what kind of 2019 title he might have occupied, but he was the guy calling the shots in Egypt. Pharaoh was still technically in charge. Joseph reports directly to Pharaoh, but it's because of Joseph and God's blessing him with the ability to interpret these dreams and get ahead of this famine that Egypt is in such a, you know, perfect position. And then Joseph's brothers appear before him. You know, they're coming to Egypt just like everybody else to buy supplies. And it's a sweet reunion. You know, Joseph is touched. And not at this first meeting, but at a future meeting, Joseph reveals himself to his family members who, through one way or another, Joseph's ability to pull strings and control matters in Egypt, Joseph's family now become guests of Joseph in Egypt. I mean, they go from not having any food to eat to now they're living a life we can only imagine similar to Joseph, who's enjoying great luxury and benefits and blessings. It's not all good though, because Exodus chapter 1 introduces us to a new Pharaoh, the Bible says. A new Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. A new king is in charge in Egypt who did not know Joseph. So, you get a new guy on top calling the shots. And he can undo everything that the guy before him did, you know, and that's what this Pharaoh proceeds to do. He looks and he observes this new Pharaoh in town, Exodus chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. He looks and he observes that the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. And this new Pharaoh does some quick back of the envelope math. And hey, if these children of Israel all rally together, you know, Lord of the Flies style, and just kind of decide they're going to take over, they'll put up quite a fight. You know, they will put up quite a fight. And maybe that's a fight we can't win, seeing that the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are, Exodus chapter 1, verse 9. So this new Pharaoh enacts certain policy reforms that will make the children of Israel serve with rigor. Exodus chapter 1, verse 10, New King James Version says, this Pharaoh said, let's deal shrewdly with them. And you remember, it's this Pharaoh who enacts the population control measures that we famously talk about. Remember what those are? They're spelled out in chapter 1, Exodus chapter 1, verses 18 and following. If a Hebrew midwife discovers a male child, what were her instructions? Get rid of them. A female child you keep alive, you know. But this was the new Pharaoh's very, very draconian population control. You know, we'll just get rid of all the guys. And it is soon thereafter that Moses is born. Moses, who will emerge as a great leader of God's people. Joseph, before he dies, I find this rather interesting. Joseph, before he dies, makes an unusual request. Genesis chapter 50, verse 25. This request regarding his bones. He requests that his bones be buried where? He wants his bones to be buried in the land that God promised his people. They were still, you know, strangers, guests in the land of Egypt. And Joseph, before he dies, speaking these words, allude to a promise, a faith that he has that God's people will see their land again. You know, they won't stay in Egypt forever. And of course, many, many years later, Joseph is the man, the name of the man who's Mary's husband. That's just a fun fact. No direct, you know, relationship. But, you know, you get up in heaven one of these days and figure out God did that on purpose. I wouldn't be surprised, would you? That's such a key messianic figure in Genesis, the close of Genesis, is named the same as the husband of Mary's. I'm sorry, the husband of Mary. In Exodus chapter 1, we have this new king with his new rules, and Moses. Moses emerges, and his life goes by like a flash. He's born for us in the early chapters of Exodus here. And then next thing we know, he's standing before God in a burning bush, Exodus chapter 3. Next thing we know, Moses is marching right into Pharaoh's palace again, the home that he grew up in, ironically, because who was the adoptive mother of Moses? Pharaoh's daughter. Yeah, Pharaoh's daughter was the adoptive mother of Moses. So here's Moses coming back into Pharaoh's house. And Moses this time is bringing a message from God, a message that says what? Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Let my people go. Moses, maybe better than anybody, had a front row seat at just what Pharaoh could do. I wonder, right? We have to wonder and speculate. I wonder just how many people Moses noticed disappeared when they crossed Pharaoh. You know, that guy who was causing a scene the other night and saying these out-of-place things about Pharaoh, we hadn't seen him around anymore. Perhaps Moses was witness to a lot of that, as many would be witness to a lot of that under the direction of a very shrewd and bloodthirsty Pharaoh. This is the same guy, don't forget now, this is the same guy who in Exodus chapter 1 said, hey, all these little boy babies, we got to kill them. This Pharaoh's not afraid to, you know, kill some folks, to get his hands dirty if he thinks that's what needs to be done. And don't also forget that in this culture, ancient Egypt, they deified their pharaohs. They worshiped them like God. I mean, here was a guy, Pharaoh, who could literally do no wrong in the eyes of the people. And so Moses comes in. Moses is described for us elsewhere in Scripture as a very, very meek man. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Lets us know that that doesn't mean Moses was a pushover. That doesn't mean that Moses was a coward. Being meek and being cowardly aren't the same thing. Being meek and being, you know, timid and unwilling to speak up and stand out, those aren't the same thing. So Moses comes into Pharaoh's palace, a palace that he's no doubt familiar with, having been raised there. And Moses says, let my people go. Verse 2, Pharaoh's response is what? Who is the Lord? Who is the Lord? Everything we've just quickly noticed about Pharaoh all indicates to us that he ain't impressed with God. Pharaoh is in charge of Egypt. And last time anybody checked, Egypt's doing really, really, really well. Egypt is, even to this day, ancient Egypt is even to this day a marvel of ancient civilization. I mean, we look over there and we think, man, this is quite an impressive feat that these ancient Egyptians accomplished. And Pharaoh has disdain for this God that Joseph's on the brain, that Moses brings word of. Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord." Truer words never been spoken. "I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." Well, God says, "Okay, it's time for you and I to get acquainted." And what follows next is a gospel meeting. I think of it as that sometimes. A gospel meeting that God preaches to Pharaoh. 10 sermons in this gospel meeting. We know them better as these 10 plagues. Maybe your Bible has chapter headings or paragraph breaks. But this takes up a lengthy part of the book of Exodus, beginning in chapter 7. So we're moving quite rapidly. We have probably about 4-ish, 5-ish chapters of these 10 plagues. And 7 through 12. Thank you, Sam. I said 4-ish, and Sam said, "Nah, it's 5. It's 7 through 12. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate that. In ascending intensity, right? These plagues start relatively minor, but the last one's a doozy. You remember what it was? The last plague in Egypt was what? The death of the firstborn. And that finally sends Pharaoh to his knees. But before that happens, you know, we have this plague of water being turned into blood. Exodus chapter 7, second half of that. Before this, though, there is a notable miracle performed by Moses. Moses and Aaron once again are interceding on behalf of God's people, and they're taunted by Pharaoh. This is chapter 7, verse 9. We won't bog down too much, but chapter 7, verse 9, Pharaoh says, "Show me a miracle." And Aaron takes the rod from his hand and casts it down, and it becomes a serpent. Well, that's mighty impressive, you know. But the sleight-of-hand magicians who populated Pharaoh's court, the sorcerers, they're called magicians, they're called, chapter 7, verse 11, New King James Version, they did what appeared to be the same thing. Now, obviously, you know, they did not miraculously, like Moses and Aaron did. These magicians and sorcerers did not miraculously turn their staffs into snakes. But they did something, you know, kind of close your eyes real fast. And the way you trick your kids, the way you kind of fool somebody casually. And they performed what appeared to be the same trick with their enchantments. Chapter 7, verse 11 spells out for us, lest we have in our mind that, wow, these magicians, these sorcerers, doing the same thing that Moses and Aaron are doing. Nuh-uh, not so. It's kind of similar tone of Acts chapter 8, where you'd have Simon the sorcerer and Philip, who's able to work these miracles. And you know, once the people saw and beheld the miracles that Philip was able to do, they quit being impressed with Simon. You know, there's a better show in town. And that really hit Simon the sorcerer where it hurt. Well, here it appears that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, they're kind of outperforming God's people. But what happens next? What does the snake that Moses made, what does he do? He starts eating up all the other snakes, right? These aren't the same. These aren't the same. And these poor magicians here, they were hiding the sticks, you know, behind their back or wherever. I don't know exactly how it went down, obviously. But they clearly did not do what Moses and Aaron did, even though it appeared that they did. But God set that record straight. As he is about to set the whole record straight with these 10 plagues, the first of which we mentioned, waters turn to blood, and then there's a plague of frogs that come on the land, and then lice, knock on wood, our family's never dealt with lice throughout all of our years of public school, and I hope that trend continues, but can you imagine a plague of lice just all over, everywhere, you know, back in the old days, right, where they didn't have as up-to-date methods of eradication as we have. Flies, pestilence, boils, hail, locusts, darkness. And with each of these plagues, Pharaoh's heart is pricked. And Pharaoh appears as though he's going to bend the knee to God. But every time Pharaoh says, okay, make it stop, get rid of these flies, get rid of these frogs, get rid of this these boils, and I'll let God's people go. Every time Pharaoh says that, what's he do? Changes his mind. Yeah, he changes his mind. He goes back on his word. And the 10th and final plague gets Pharaoh's attention for a bit longer. As mentioned, the firstborn are going to die throughout all of Egypt, including Pharaoh's firstborn. That was not universal, however. There was a mechanism in place for this death angel to pass over the homes. You remember what that mechanism involved? Say it again. Yeah, blood. Mm-hmm. Blood was the safety marker, right? And as you sink your teeth into this, you see that there's salvation associated with blood, which will feature very prominently later in the New Testament when we're told in Romans 5 that we are saved by Christ's blood. We don't have to face the death of our souls. And it kind of echoes this Exodus event, which was commemorated by the Jews every subsequent year. They marked this on their calendars, and they had a Passover feast which reminded them of this night in Egypt, when on one morning everybody woke up and found the firstborn dead. But not God's people, not those doors on whose pillars out front had the blood on it. After this plague, 10th and final, Pharaoh says go. And he means it, at least at first. So Moses leads God's people out of Egypt, you remember? Exodus chapter 15, roughly, we are in now. And no sooner than the children of Israel kind of shrink down as they are walking away from Egypt, distance between them and Egypt, making them smaller in the horizon. No sooner than that happens, does Pharaoh say what? Nuh-uh, I changed my mind again. And Pharaoh sends the armies of Egypt after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel find themselves with the armies of Egypt behind them. And Exodus chapter 14, what's in front of them? The Red Sea. And the children of Israel, they're not their best selves in Exodus chapter 14, are they? They seem rather reluctant to leave Egypt. As a matter of fact, later in the children of Israel's life, they will fondly think back to their stay in Egypt, which is so weird. When the children of Israel are hungry, they will whine and complain to Moses, and they'll say, well, when we were in Egypt, we had plenty to eat, which isn't true, but their false memory is making it true in their minds. Well, here they are whining and saying things to Moses like, well, what are you doing? You bring us out here, Exodus chapter 14, verse 11, you bring us out here to die? Wouldn't it be better for us to die in Egypt? And we begin to see what kind of people these people are. Moses says to the people, don't be afraid. Stand still. Exodus 14, 13. See the salvation of the Lord. And the children of Israel step out, and their foot hits dry ground, as God miraculously allows them to cross the Red Sea. The rapidly pursuing Egyptian army says, hey, if they can do it, we can do it. Right? Wrong. Because as the armies of Egypt follow in hot pursuit, what happens to the waters? They come back, drowning all of the armies of Egypt. And so the children of Israel are now out of Egypt. And God has great plans to guide them into the promised land. God is going to show them this promised land. In Numbers chapter 12 and 13, the book of Numbers exists in our Bible as just a simple census of the people. God wanted us to know, he wanted them to know how many of them came out of Egypt, so that this would serve as kind of a national baseline, and they could evaluate their population up or down from this number. They are directed to the promised land, where God says you need to send some spies in and figure out the best way to take this land. God promises to give it to them. But he does direct them to send some spies out. These spies come back with a very famous pessimistic report. And the Bible lets us know that the hearts of the people melted. You know, they did not believe that they could go in and take this land. Remember what was famously said by 10 of these 12 spies, one spy from every tribe? What was famously said by 10 of these 12 spies about the inhabitants of the land? They're giants! Yeah. It boggles my mind how they come back, these spies come back from the land, Numbers chapter 13, Numbers chapter 14, and they say, good news, bad news, y'all. Good news is everything that God said is right. Man, this is surely a prosperous land. Numbers chapter 13, verse 27, we went to the land. It truly flows with milk and honey. Well, God said it would. Here's the fruit of the land, luscious fruit, a great place to live. But, verse 28, Numbers 14, 28. So, you kind of have to throw your head in all sorts of strange gears, you know. Forward we go because God is giving us this land, and isn't it great? But, verse 28, we can't do it. Well, God's not going to let them go into this land. Instead, they are going to march in a big giant circle until these people die off and better folks come to be blessed by the promised land. We'll talk about them next week. What we've done tonight is go into Egypt and come out of Egypt real, real fast. But we're advancing this survey of our Old Testament. Thanks a lot for studying it with us and answering all those questions we asked. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.